The Lord be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to John. Many of the Jews who had come to Mary and seen what Jesus had done began to believe in him. Some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees convened the Sanhedrin and said, "What are we going to do? This man is performing many signs. If we leave him alone, all will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our land and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing, nor do you consider that it is better for you that one man should die instead of the people, so that the whole nation may not perish." He did not say this on his own, but since he was high priest for that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not only for the nation, but also to gather into one the dispersed children of God. So from that day on, they planned to kill him. So Jesus no longer walked about in public among the Jews, but he left for the region near the desert to a town called Ephraim, and there he remained with his disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before Passover to purify themselves. They looked for Jesus and said to one another as they were in the temple area, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast?" The Gospel of the Lord.
In our first reading today, through the prophet Ezekiel, the Lord articulates a very powerful promise. But at the center of that promise is something eternal, something that will never pass away. And he speaks of a sanctuary that he will raise up. And the moment the Lord begins speaking in this way, we recognize he is not speaking of merely an earthly land, an earthly promised land. He is not speaking of a merely earthly Jerusalem, but of something much greater than that. And while the promise involves a certain land, and while the promise involves Jerusalem, it goes beyond it. Because the scattered children that he would gather to himself are not merely the sons and daughters of Israel, but fallen man, dispersed into many nations around the world. It is a vision that emerges addressing Israel, but reaches beyond it. And that the Lord doing something there will plant something into place which will endure even into eternity itself. It is a remarkable, remarkable promise. And that promise is what is at issue in our gospel reading today, in this recounting of what happened after Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. The last of his great signs, the sign that takes place before he enters Jerusalem, when his word reaches into a tomb and summons a dead man back to life. And this miracle caused a great stir, a great commotion, and great worry after it happened. And being here with 2,000 years of distance, we wonder, why would anybody be upset by that? A dead man comes back to life. But this was a sign that could not be ignored. This was a sign that could not be dismissed. This is a sign that demanded a response. There was no way to overlook it. There was no way to pretend it didn't happen. And there was no way to remain indifferent to it. And so as word of this prodigious miracle reaches Jerusalem, we see that the Sanhedrin is so troubled, they convene a special session. And note now what preoccupies them. This man, this Jesus, they say, is working many great signs. The implication would be, maybe we should get on board with the program. But note, he is working many great signs demonstrating the truth of his ministry. If we leave him alone, the people will all end by believing in him. Therefore, we must stop him. Note how invincibly closed these minds and these hearts are. He is working many great signs. The people will all end by believing in him. Therefore, we must bring him to an end. That the people not come to belief in him. And one it puzzles over this, and one wonders, why would these men of God be so defensive, be so threatened by what are manifest acts of God? And so it continues. If the people believe in him, the Romans will be provoked. And if the Romans are provoked, we will lose what we have. We will lose our nation. We will lose ourselves. And so note the misguided patriotism that is at play here. For the good of the nation, they say, we must stop him. For the good of ourselves, and why? Because they cannot see beyond an earthly promise to Israel. When the Lord always points beyond that merely earthly promise to something greater. And so they are willing to turn their back on the possibility of the new covenant for the sake of clinging to the scraps of the old. Israel is not free. Israel is not a nation at this time. Israel is a conquered people. And they are frightened. They are frightened as all men and women who feel overwhelmed and overmastered by the world around them are. When we cling to those little things that we think make us who we are. And because we feel so threatened, those little things become so very, very important. This is nothing new in human history. We see it time and time again on the part of believers, on the part of unbelievers, that when one feels threatened, one grabs and one holds on. And in that clinging, one becomes hardened, one becomes closed, one becomes angry, one becomes frustrated. And so it is. We have the reunion of frustrated men. All of them feeling threatened and worried in many ways. Their questions are not bad ones. Their concerns are not bad ones. Are we losing ourselves? Are we losing our culture? Are we losing our country? Note how these are the same questions we hear around us almost every day today. They're not bad questions. But when they're asked in fear, and answered in fear and frustration, usually the engaging of those questions does not go well. And so Jesus here is understood to be a threat, and we must do something about the threat. The signs do not matter at all, except they indicate just how big a threat he is. What a remarkable moment this is. As great as the Lord acts, these frightened, insecure hearts, despite their power, despite their status, despite their role in the temple, or perhaps because of all of those things, feel strangely small and insecure in the face of it. And so it is in this context, what will we do? Everything will come crashing down. That the high priest, Caiaphas, stands up and says, quiet down. Quiet down. And suddenly there's a voice that says, why are we panicking? Don't you understand what must be done? And at first glance, one thinks we have a voice of reason intruding here. At first glance, we believe we have someone who's going to say, why are we so upset? But then note what he says. Well, then it's better that we make a sacrifice for the good of the nation, for the good of the people. And note this interplay of the political and the religious here. This is not a purely religious statement. It's not a purely political statement. It's both. And then underscores the danger that happens when these two things are woven too tightly together. Because always the political overwhelms the religious. For the good of the people, one man must die. And if he dies, the people will be saved. Note the irony here. He's speaking out of political calculation. If the Lord is eliminated, we will have no threat from Rome, and we'll be just fine. He will die, and the people will be fine. We will be saved from that external threat about which we are so worried. But note, if he dies, as far as they're concerned, Jesus is also then dead and gone, and will never trouble us again. And so note the calculation. We sacrifice one of us for the benefit of all of us. But it's a death-dealing sacrifice. It says that only destruction can save us. And we hear that those in the room are in agreement with him, that one must die to save the nation. And they agree with the political calculus that comes with it. And so we will go, we will put him to death, and we will feel justified in doing it because we're protecting and defending the people. Note how neatly that works out. It's not murder now. It's defense of the people. It's not turning our back on God now. It's defense of the people. And yet, as St. John points out, the irony is that Caiaphas' words are entirely correct, despite the malicious spirit in which he speaks them. And so we see here that the high priest does have a prophetic role. And the high priest accurately prophesied but didn't understand the prophecy he himself was making. Because, in fact, this is the plan of God, that one will sacrifice himself for the many, for all. But no, the world doesn't sacrifice Jesus. The petty politics of the temple does not offer Jesus up, however much they think they do. The Lord will offer himself up. And in doing so, he will show a priesthood that is greater than ever acted in the temple. The Lord will offer himself up, and in doing so, he himself will be a sacrifice that is greater than the thousands upon thousands of the sacrifices offered in that temple since the moment of its establishment. Note how marvelous this really is. And what does the Holy Spirit say through St. John? And he will die for the nation, and not just that one nation, and not just that one people. Jesus doesn't die simply so that all goes well for Israel. Jesus dies for the salvation of all men. And the scattered children that God seeks to bring to himself are dispersed across all of the nations of the globe, and he dies for all of those scattered children of the Lord. Note the breadth of this, the scope of this. It goes so far beyond what these men in their frightened conversation can even begin to imagine. That even those nations at war with them, the Romans, Jesus will die for them too. That even the ancient enemies, the Philistines, Jesus will die for them too. Note the scope of this. Oh, he will die for the good of all, but not for one nation segregated out of all the others, but for that true nation of mankind that originally did speak one language before their tongues were mixed and dispersed. Note how powerful this is. And so it is now that we see everything comes to a head. There is the plotting of those in the temple, the plotting of the leaders to eliminate him, and they've justified themselves now. They will act with a pretense of holiness and goodness and authenticity because they're caring for the people, even if it means sending a man to his death. And then there is the Lord, who acts out of a true sense of the good of the people, who cannot save themselves, who cannot rescue themselves, who have nothing they can sacrifice to restore themselves to God, except him, who will offer himself. Note the two movements. To the eye of man, it's the movement from the temple that determines everything. But in the eye of God, it is always the movement of Jesus Christ that determines the outcome. Because as he says, no one takes my life from me. I have the power to lay it down, and I will. And I will take it up again, because I have the power to do so. And so it is then. The meeting is over. The men go to their homes because the Passover is near and they must be ready. And so note, with murder on their hearts, they are going to purify themselves so that they can celebrate the feasts, a feast which will involve putting an innocent man to death. But they'll be purified. And then there is the question, what of Jesus? Will he come? When will he come? And note the answer. Do you really think he would stay away from the feast? Do you really think that he wouldn't come? And note how neatly the gospel reading drops us right there with the question. And the implication is that we need to supply the answer to that. Do we think that Jesus will hold himself away, or do we think that Jesus will be there to finish the work he has come to do? And as we in our hearts say our yes, of course he will come, note what that says about what we do tomorrow and over the days that follow. Because tomorrow begins the great and holy week. And tomorrow it is not merely a matter that Jesus shows up for the holy days. Of course he does. The real issue is, do we show up too? And when we show up, how do we show up? Do we show up like those vicious men from the temple who are more interested in defending ourselves from the threat of grace? Or do we show up with Christ, going forward, recognizing that this is a movement that now is not the private movement of Jesus, but a movement in which we all participate? And this movement, heralded by this word that goes into a tomb and summons a man who was dead back to life, that this movement involves us. And as we look through this week, what do we see? We see another tomb and a man lying dead within it. And yet there is no word that summons that man back to life, because that man is the Word made flesh. And that man will step out of the tomb. Note how wonderful this last sign of Jesus is then. He announces and demonstrates he is powerful even over death. He shows that he will reach even into a tomb and snatch life out of it. And ironically, the men who reject the sign don't get the memo. If he can speak into a grave and bring a dead man to life, what makes us think that we can just kill him? Note the irony there. If he can speak into a grave and call forth a dead man, what makes us think we can just eliminate him? He'll come, but note the question that really hangs in the air. The question that really hangs in the air is not whether or not Jesus will die. The question that hangs in the air is, what happens after that? Fortunately, we do know the end of the story. And what happens after that is going to be right here on this altar in just a couple minutes. Because the Lord who will not remain in the grave is here with us. And that same Lord is here so that we can come forward and meet him. And note how beautiful it is. Because over this coming week, we're going to hear a phrase over and over again. And that phrase is to be handed over. Jesus is handed over to the Jews. The Jews hand him over to Pilate. Judas betrays him and hands him over to his enemies. But note what happens here. You'll come forward. You'll open your mouth. You'll stretch out your hand. And it's not Judas. It's not the priests and the Pharisees. And it's not the Romans. It's Jesus himself who will hand himself over to you. He has the power to lay down his life. He has the power to take it up again. And he has the love that impels him to hand himself over to you and over to me. And when we receive him, we receive that same victory over death that the Lord so powerfully manifested in front of the tomb of Lazarus, his friend, and then later more fully on the day of his resurrection. Amen.